The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, I want to welcome everybody to another edition of the Russian Orthodox Medievalist. I'm Matt Johnson, and I am here on the Voice of Reason radio network. I want to thank everyone at the Voice of Reason for helping me in this program and for asking me to do this. I thank them for the confidence they have in me. This program today, and the programs that we do so long as the show is in existence, deals with Russia and all three of its major periods, the pre-revolutionary, the Bolshevik era, and the contemporary era. And we deal with all three of these eras, historically and religiously and aesthetically and every other way. We do this with the purpose of showing Russia's place, as of 2009, showing Russia's place as the leader of the forces against the New World Order. That is the fundamental idea, the fundamental proposition that this program takes as its starting point. And so on this program, we go all over the place. We'll go all over the place in terms of topics, in terms of time periods, in terms of personalities and ideas, but everything is reducible to that one contemporary idea that Russia, the Russians, and the Orthodox Church, which is so substantially identified with Russia, Ukraine, and Serbia, that this entity is the vanguard of the battle against the New World Order. So let's keep that very clear, and let's keep that straight as you listen to this. This is very important. So everything that we do is unified and integrated with that single concept. But as far as today is concerned, this is the end of April 2009. What we're going to do today is something by request. I received an email asking me to do something on the Mongols and the nature of the Mongol occupation of at least most of Russia, how it came about, what happened, what were its effects. And I've heard in the past that this is a topic that a lot of people are very interested in because it has a lot to do with how Russia developed later on. It certainly has a lot to do with the ethnic and racial background of the Russian people as a whole. Now, I have a book out on medieval Russia, which at the moment I have only in electronic format on my site. And I have some work on the Mongols done in writing. But today, let's do this in some detail. Deal with the Mongols, who they are, and what happened, 13th and 14th century, that led to Russia being, for a long time, a colony of a major Asiatic power. And as it stands, the Mongols maintain the largest land-based empire in the history of the world. So, let's start from the beginning. Who are the Mongols? The Mongols are an Asiatic people. They're nomads that lived in the area of northern China, what we call Mongolia, and parts of southern Siberia. The Chinese, who the Mongols had destroyed and occupied for a long period of time, held that the Mongols, at least early on in their development, had no real culture. There was no real literacy, there was no real literature, there was no real art. Their entire universe revolved around two things. Number one, the horse, and number two, weaponry, the martial arts in all of their forms. The Chinese, at the time, of course, were a fairly advanced civilization, viewed the Mongols as savages, viewed them as an acultural people that were really capable only of conquering. And then afterwards, the most basic and rudimentary approach to administration. But the real unifier, these nomadic tribes, which really had no history, they certainly had no impact on history prior to Genghis Khan, who dies in 1227. He is a nobleman, and he is the person in destroying and essentially enslaving the southern nomadic tribes of the plain in the Far East, unified most of these vaguely Asiatic peoples into some kind of cohesive force. Now, as far as Russia is concerned, by the time that Genghis Khan and his successors deal with the Russians, all of China, all of Indochina, all of Central Asia, and in fact a large portion of Western Asia, is under Mongol control. And in the process of conquering these people, the Khans, Khan of course is a title, the Khans have gained a tremendous amount of money, tremendous amount of resources, and an empire that is continually taking the best fighting men from the conquered peoples, specifically the cavalry, and impressing them into the Mongol army. So the real unfortunate element of being Russian at this time is that not only are they facing a large, very well-led empire, but they're facing the empire really at its zenith. It's facing a young, vigorous society that has conquered the most advanced parts of the world at the time, some of the wealthiest parts of the world at the time. So by the time they hit Russian territory, Turkish territory, they are already a substantially wealthy and experienced, battle-hardened group of people. Now, in their move northward, the Mongol movement is initially southward into Indochina, and then consistently westward, right up to the borders of the Turkish Empire, and then northward, straight into Russia. That means, as far as Russia is concerned, the very first group of people the Russians are in regular intercourse with that learn of the Mongol advance are the Turkish tribes of the southern plain, the southern steppe of Russian society. They are very quickly dispatched, but emissaries of these tribes show up in Russia, show up throughout Ukraine and northern Russia, warning the Russian people that a heretofore unknown entity has very quickly made short work of their otherwise formidable fighting force. And therefore, the Russians have to be worried. The emissaries of the Turkish tribes of the south come forward and say, we've been enemies in the past, but we can't be anymore. And we can't be enemies anymore because we have this new enemy who is probably stronger than all of us put together. But the initial confrontations, the Turks and the Russians on one side and the Mongols on the other, were completely disastrous. There was no planning. There was no coordination, and this is going to come up again and again in this particular period of time. We're talking about now the middle of the 13th century, roughly. And not only is there no trust between the Turks and the Slavs, but there's no trust amongst the various princes, which at this time the Russian lands are dispersed among. There is no modern Russia. There is no unified Russia, really, until the time of Ivan III. And we're going to deal with him some other time. Suffice it to say that by the death of Genghis Khan in 1227, Russia is, politically speaking, not a unified entity. For the most part, she is unified linguistically, and for the most part, she's unified religiously, and therefore culturally. But they are not unified politically and militarily. In 1224, one of the first confrontations between the Russian princes and the Mongols, the leaders of the Russian forces did not wait for the Ukrainians from Kiev to show up in this confrontation because they were afraid that the Kievans would take too much of the glory. But after these initial scouting forays into Russian territory, for 13 years the Mongols will disappear. Most say that these are simply scouting attacks where some of the nomadic tribes are largely exterminated and the Mongols are testing the waters to see exactly what kind of force they have to come up against in these heretofore unknown Slavic lands. Of course, they're not particularly impressed with what they experience. What they experience is relatively small, uncoordinated Slavic armies that are more concerned with personal issues and rank and debates among the various Russian princes rather than defending their homeland. 13 years later, the beginning of the 1240s, the Mongols will show up in extremely large numbers, and they will take on, first and foremost, they will take on the two largest Russian principalities, Ryazan and Suzdal. They are the first two in line to be destroyed. Even as early as 1238, most of Russia has been quickly subdued by the Mongol forces. Between 1239 and 1240, most of southern Russia has been destroyed and depopulated. The only place that they were unable to take was the northern, very European merchant city of Novgorod. Novgorod is just Russian for new city. It is a maritime republic, which is controlled by an elective king. We'll deal with Novgorod some other time. It's a worthwhile topic in and of itself because it does have a republican constitution and yet is purely Russian and purely Orthodox in its culture. Novgorod is the largest member of the Hanseatic League of Northern Europe, so they are very much plugged in to the workings of the Dutch, the Germans, and the Scandinavians in terms of international trade. And lastly, the beginning of the 1240s, Kiev is sacked and completely destroyed. So it doesn't take long for almost all of Russia, with the exception of Novgorod, to be destroyed. And the only thing that saved Novgorod itself is that her landholding, although substantial, is mostly swamp. And as a result of that, the Mongol horsemen really would rather not go through that. And so they left Novgorod alone, but it was understood that the Novgorodians had to pay the Mongols a regular tribute to save the city-state from being destroyed.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com.
We have a financial crisis in California, but I wanted to make sure that you all know that even though we have this crisis, we will not be short of money when it comes to fighting those fires. We will be there for you 100%. We feel sorry and bad for the people of Santa Barbara that year after year you get hit by those fires, but it's very important to us that we show our support, and I want to compliment you here in Santa Barbara, law enforcement and the fire officials and everyone, because there's no place in the state where people come together faster and jump into action faster than right here in this area. Santa Barbara has been fantastic, from law enforcement to the fire officials to the residents. Everyone has cooperated, and I just wanted to give you some of the statistics and some of the numbers that we have just gotten. Has a set of fire that there's 1,300 acres that have burned so far. 3,500 homes have been threatened. Dozens of homes have been destroyed. There's 5,400 homes that have been evacuated. Then there's the evacuation of people. 13,500 mandatory and 13,000 have been voluntarily, evacuating their homes. Some of them were able, like I think 1,200 were able to move back in yesterday.
Let's return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
The next major topic, really the causes of the Russian defeat. The first thing you guys should realize is that the Mongols attacked Russia in the wintertime. It's kind of a myth that the Russian cold, and I've said this before, has really been the cause of defeats of enemy forces in the past. It certainly did do its job both on Hitler and Napoleon. But as I've said elsewhere, the real issue was the thaw and the mud and the impassability of the roads. The Mongol scouting parties in the 1220s and a little later figured this out. And figured out that horses would be very, very bad in the springtime. Really the best time to do any kind of fighting is in the summertime. But the Mongols decided that the best time to attack Russia is in the winter, the dead of winter, which was really no big deal for the Mongols. They are a cold weather people after all. And even further than that, that all of the waterways were frozen. And therefore, the Khans realized that the horses would have a straight shot on Russian territory when you don't have to worry about the water. Causes of the Russian defeat. The very simple cause is Mongol superiority in numbers. People forget that not only had the Mongols developed the largest land empire in the history of the world to this very date by the end of the 1240s, but that they also had put together, just in terms of sheer numbers, the largest armies, all based on horsemen, to that point. The Mongols invaded Russia with an army of roughly 500,000, 500,000. They had collected infantry from all over Asia, from the Mongolian steppes through China, Indochina, India, and onward. Everywhere else they've been, everywhere else they've come. By the time they get to Russia, they have a ridiculously large force. The Mongols are also completely unified. At this stage, as early as it's not going to last, of course, but they are completely unified at this stage in their development. They have a single leader. They have a very rational pyramid system of officers. And of course, on the other hand, the Russians were completely disjointed. They were not unified. They were based on petty princedoms. And really, the remainder of Russian history after the Mongols start to weaken, a century or so later, Russian history is going to be based on the centralization of political power, which is another way of saying the crushing of the old aristocracy. That's going to be a major theme, and it's always going to be understood that the main reason the Russians not only lost to the Mongols, but pretty much like everyone else, didn't even give the Mongols much of a fight. The Mongols were overwhelming with numbers, but just as important, they also overwhelmed their opponents by the unity of their movements. The Mongols were also too quick. Everything is based around horses bred in East Asia. They're bred for speed, The Mongols moved quicker than any army that had ever existed up until that period of time. And because they moved so quickly, everybody's timetable was completely thrown off. Alliances couldn't form and contracts drawn up and everything else with an enemy that moved at this extremely fast rate of speed. But not only were the Russians and Slavs of the area, not only were they not unified in their command, they were not unified in their tactics, they did not trust one another, but they were also divided in terms of social class. Fact is that the Russian peasantry was not a part of the army. These were elite, aristocratic corps, loosely joined together with their servitors, wearing, you know, old-style armor, heavier, slower horses, and really having no clue and having no understanding of the amazing advances that the Mongols had made in terms of tactics and in terms of weaponry. Furthermore, the Mongols are substantially experienced. They're battle-hardened soldiers. And they, in their defeat of the Russian forces, they create a massive, wealthy land empire. It won't be long, however, before the Russian branch of the Mongol forces under Khan Uzbek, where we get the name Uzbekistan, Khan Uzbek broke away from the Mongolian empire and formed what has come down to us, the Golden Horde. The Golden Horde is the Russian branch of the Mongol Empire. It will, in essence, from 1260 onward, or really 1260 until the coming of Tamerlane, which is a whole different story, remain a very large, powerful, independent state. Now, a few things about the Mongols that need to be understood. Number one, the armies were self-sufficient. They didn't have supply line problems because they didn't have supply lines. The Mongol cavalryman is trained from the moment that he can walk. But walking isn't particularly important to the Mongols. Everything that a Mongol did was done on a horse. All meetings were done on horses. Fighting was done on horses. All communication with others was done on horses. The Mongol cavalryman learned how to hunt. He learned how to take what was necessary from the local environment. The Mongol cavalryman lived on mare's milk, on horse milk, and the meat that he was able to hunt was cooked underneath the saddle of the horse. So the meat was placed under the saddle, and then in the heat, it would be hot even in wintertime, the meat would be very lightly cooked between the skin of the horse and the saddle. And that's how they prepared their meat. And we call that today, in reference to their origin, a steak tartare, or the Tartar steak, the Mongol steak, that still is served, which is, of course, extremely rare. The initial way was to cook the meat between the horse and the saddle, and then it would be eaten after that. So there's no supply lines. The Mongol soldier trained from an extremely young age, both in the bow as well as the sword, did everything worth doing on a horse. He was even married on a horse. By the time that the Mongol soldier became a man, the horse was not a separate being. The horse became a separate appendage. The horse became an appendage of the soldier himself, and he could control the horse and its movements as easily and as accurately as he controlled the movements of his own body. Everybody who faced the Mongol horde had this very same reaction. The horse was a part of his body. These horses were fast. and the armies were completely self-sufficient. Therefore, they can go wherever was required of them, and can stay for an indefinite period of time. This is what actually frightened the Mongols about the Novgorodian territory. The salt marshes and the swamps of that part of northwestern Russia, it was not particularly hospitable to the Mongol way of warfare, and at least as far as they were concerned, as far as the Mongols were concerned, may not yield the sort of supply that the average Mongol cavalry force required. But what about the influence? The influence of the Mongols, I'm going to hold, was minimal. I'm going to say this because, primarily, first of all, there is no substantial political change. The only substantial, and this is really not a substantial difference, this is really a matter of administration. The only thing that really changes is that in order for a Russian prince to sit on the local, there is no central throne at all. Kiev is now destroyed, and even prior to the Mongol invasion, Kiev only had a symbolic importance, and again, we'll deal with that some other time as well. There is no center of Russian life. Culturally speaking, the church acted as a center, but that's not a political matter, that's not a military matter. So all of these thrones were local and based around major cities. And the cities themselves were cities only because they were the military foundation of the locality, and therefore the seat of the prince. The prince was expected to fight, was expected to know how to operate a horse, and have all that was necessary to lead his men into battle. A prince can be deposed if he's a failure in battle. Now, that's going to change, because the only thing now that's going to guarantee that a prince can sit on his local throne is Mongol power. Every Russian prince now has to get what's called a yarlik, a Mongol word for patent or license. That means that the leader of the Golden Horde agrees that such and such a person can sit on the throne of Rezan or whatever, anywhere. The second thing was that the Mongols didn't mix very well with Russians. The Mongol horde was based in the extreme south of the country. This was the center of the Mongol Empire in the west. What's going to happen is that the Mongols will now realize that they have to not simply wander around the earth conquering peoples. They now have to administer the territories under their control. And you're going to see a major change, which is going to be the end of the Mongol Empire by the 15th century, and that is the Mongols will become bureaucrats. Becoming a bureaucrat is the death of any people. The bureaucratic mentality is the complete opposite of youth and vigor and creativity and spontaneity. It is the essence of everything that's boring and routine. In other words, the Mongols get fat. Begins to happen is that the Mongols will become a nation of bureaucrats and administrators. Slowly but surely, they will lose that tremendous speed, their intimate connection with horses, and the breed, the initial stock in which they were raised in East Asia, tremendously strong and yet tremendously fast, absolutely fearless in battle, would never rear up no matter what happened to it. This is going to change for the Mongols. But that also meant that as administrators encamped in the extreme south of Russian territory, the capital at Saray is just a Mongol word that means throne, the Golden Horde will judge all Russian disputes. Any political dispute, tax disputes, etc., will, in the final court of law, either the Supreme Court, the final court of law in Russia, will be the throne at Saray. Mongols become very adept at playing the Russians off against Europeans. Remember, the initial attack, the Mongol forces, Northern Russians were invaded by the Lithuanians and the Swedes. A Northern European coalition, and actually the nature of the Livonian Knights and these other groups we'll deal with some other time, but a Northern European coalition will take advantage of Russia's temporary weakness and invade the country very soon after the initial invasion of Russia. So the Russians, the Slavs, are being attacked, it should be noted, from two angles. They're being attacked from the south and the east by the Mongol horsemen, but once the Northern Europeans realize that this is going on, they take advantage and invade Russia from the north and from the west. This means, and this is another major issue at the time, this means that Russian political elites have to make a choice. It appears that the independence of our Russian people is now impossible, since we're being squeezed by two powerful forces. Who are we going to pick? Who are we going to side with? Because of the influence of Alexander Nevsky, one of the princes of the north, Prince of Novgorod, and its client state of Pskov, Alexander will choose to stay with the Mongols. Why is this? It's very, very clear why this is. The circumstance is that Russia cannot be independent. They will be occupied by one or the other powers, either a German-led coalition or a Mongol army. The problem is that the German-led coalition was actually invading Russia on the orders of the Pope at the time. Russia is weak. We could take advantage. We could use the Teutonic and Livonian Knights to impose Roman Catholicism on the Orthodox Russian people. The Mongols, on the other hand, and this is kind of a curiosity, the Mongols held the Russian clergy for the most part in respect. They were a very superstitious people. They did not have a religion per se, but they did believe in some very vague idea of the God of Heaven. The God of Heaven has given the Khan, and keep in mind, the Khan is regularly in communication with the Pope of Rome and communication with most of the crown heads of Europe. They've learned literacy by this time, saying that the God of Heaven has given the world to us, the Mongols. Genghis himself will write to the Pope of Rome, saying that I've heard that you claim to be the vicar of God on earth, and that therefore you have the right to rule the world, not just religiously, but also politically and socially. I mean, that's an extreme statement of the papal position, but is essentially accurate. He is a priest king who, given the mandate from Jesus Christ himself, has the right to rule the world. Genghis Khan hears about this eccentricity of the Pope of Rome and writes a letter saying, oh no, you're mistaken. We have the right to rule the world. And by the way, we pretty much already do. So I guess really this is a moot issue. So the Mongols are going to really matter quite a bit in European civilization. One of the ways they do this, and this is very little known, very few people have actually done any work on this, but the Mongols will contract with the merchant city of Genoa in Italy to exploit the very lucrative trade on the Black Sea. The Mongols will learn not only to become bureaucrats and administrators, they'll also learn how to become merchants and seafarers, and they will do this in union and league with the Italian merchant city-states of the time. So this alliance is very eccentric, it's very odd, but since the major Italian states, at this time, Genoa and Florence and Venice, these states are interested really only in profit, and they will take advantage of the fact that now most of the Asian world is unified. Actually, all the Asian world is now unified under Mongol control. But that's good for us if we're Italian merchants, because we can, there's a single currency, there's a single or at least, you know, the groundwork for a single currency. A single currency didn't actually exist, but a single empire meant a single set of regulations, a single political power to deal with. This is a banker's dream. This is a merchant's dream. And therefore, the Italian response to the Mongol invasions of Asia, of Russia, even into Bulgaria, Hungary, and Austria at the time, is to join with them and really teach the Mongols how to become good merchants and good capitalists. And so you're going to see a substantial Mongol-Genoese alliance concerning the Black Sea trade and hence the trade in the Eastern Mediterranean. You're talking about a lot of cash here. You're talking about a lot of money. That means that there might be some financial interest for the Russians to support, for a time anyway, Mongol domination. For the first time in Russian history, the Russians are a united people. They're united by force, by an external force, the force of the Mongol Empire, but they're united. They're united under the tutelage of Mongolia. Mongolia is not an empire that rules directly. They do not rule Russia directly. They rule Russia indirectly. They rule Russia indirectly by nominating and approving the traditional Russian ruling class in their ancestral cities. You simply have to pay the tax, because the Yarlik costs money, of course. You have to make the obligatory pilgrimage to Sarai and kowtow to the Khan. Kowtow is actually a sort of a Slavicization of a Mongol word that refers to the act of obeisance. You come to Sarai, you stand on the opposite side of where the emperor of Sarai is enthroned. You prostrate yourself on the ground, but the kowtow is that you hit your head on the ground so hard that the emperor on the other side of the room can hear it. That's the very specific definition of the kowtow. But once you do that, you have, you know, essentially pledged yourself to the Mongols. You receive for a good price. You receive a viatic. You then are guaranteed your position of power, because you then have the right to draw on Russian, on Mongol cavalry forces in order to maintain your position on the throne. And over again in this era, Mongol forces will be utilized by Russian princes, sometimes against West Europeans and Roman Catholics, sometimes against other princes, most of the time against other princes. So what do you have? You have a series of reasons as to why Mongol overlordship will become more or less accessible and acceptable to Russian princes. Number one, better to be under the Mongols who are religiously tolerant than the German and knightly Roman Catholics that are religiously intolerant, number one. Number two, Russian princes can take advantage of the very powerful and very wealthy trade of the Black Sea and Eastern Mediterranean, which is being overseen by Mongol forces, but engaged in by the Italians, the city-state of Genoa in particular. Thirdly, it guarantees that anyone who kowtows, who pays the price for the Yarlik, and who then is dutiful in collecting taxes for the Mongol Empire, those people are guaranteed their political position. And at any moment, if they're in trouble and the Mongols view their interests as being harmed, can call upon the Mongol army to settle all scores. This means, of course, that the Mongols have a vested interest in playing off one Russian prince against another, and then, on the other hand, all Russian princes against Europeans. There are going to be some particularly rebellious Russians, and they're located, for the most part, in three places. In the small, basically, city-state societies of Tver, Pskov, and Novgorod. These are in the far north of Russia, and as a result, feel the Mongol domination the least, and yet are still taxed very heavily by their rulers who have been confirmed by the Mongol patent. So over and over again, you're going to see rebellions from these relatively wealthy trading centers in northern Russia. Very Europeanized, by the way, and their Europeanization came from their connection with the Hanseatic League, of which Novgorod in northwestern Russia is the largest and most powerful member. The Mongols will eliminate rulers who do not collect the taxes, and they are very heavy. It is a capitation tax. In other words, it's not based on families or communes, as taxes at one time had been irregularly collected, but is taxed on the individual. That means the taxes are going to go up substantially. Every male individual is considered a tax-paying entity. In the old days, and it will be the case again after the Mongols leave, taxes were assessed via the commune and the extended family, which means, for the most part, taxes were lower. So the introduction of the capitation tax means that the Mongol way of assessing taxes guarantees very high receipts, but also a very high expenditure of violence in order to extract those resources, making matters even worse. The Mongols have a method of occupying a society, and the first things that the Mongols will do, after all resistance is destroyed, the city is razed to the ground. The Mongols will assist this. I mean, the purpose, of course, is to destroy all resistance. Once that's done, the Mongols will help finance the rebuilding of the city, but in the process of so doing, after things are rebuilt and the Mongols fully dominate these areas, taxes are then being collected. The most talented workers, artisans, and intellectuals are removed from the conquered area. This is the case in Russia, as well as in places like Central Asia and India and China. They are removed from their homes and brought to the capital of the Mongol Empire, whether it be in China itself or the Golden Horde in South Russia on the Volga. Sadai, of course, is a Volgan state now that takes advantage of the substantial trade on the Volga River. And so in many ways, the Mongols have replaced the Khazars. The Khazars are a Turkic people who were middlemen in the Russian Black Sea trade. They were also middlemen in the Viking Black Sea trade as well, which, and we'll deal with this at another time, which was very brisk prior to the Mongol invasion. Now the Mongol Empire has taken over, in essence, from the Khazar Empire, the Turkish Empire on the Black Sea. Only in this case, it's not only in the Black Sea, but also on the Volga River, and act as toll gatherers, tax gatherers, for all the trade going in and out of here. And on the Black Sea, as I said, they have the agency of the Genoese banking families that are financing their operations on the Black Sea. So clearly, even though the Pope of Rome had called a crusade against the Orthodox Russians by the Livonian and Teutonic Knights, and he had done this in prior ages as well, and those knights are actually worth talking about. We will deal with them at another time in another program. The papacy is also receiving money, receiving taxes and a great degree of prestige from the Genoese and Venetian cooperation, and in fact, competition for the patronage of the Mongols on the Black Sea trade, which is worth a fortune. So for all of these reasons, you have a basic acceptance, sometimes an enthusiastic acceptance from certain people, Alexander Nevsky included, for supporting the empire itself, the Mongol Empire itself. This is one of the reasons that Moscow will become, and this again will be dealt with at another time, Moscow will become one of the dominant cities of Russia, because the Moscow princes realize that they're a very small state, they really don't matter, they matter in the Mongol era for, among other reasons, they have decided to become the most loyal tax gatherers and enforcers for the Mongol Empire. There's a lot of other people are doing this. The Muscovite city-state will eventually grow into a large empire, partially because the Muscovites realize that fighting the Mongols is impossible. So it's going to mean a massacre, so there's no point there. But we might be able to build up our power by gaining the trust of the Mongol Khan as enforcers and tax gatherers, building up our own treasury, and as a result, building up our own forces. And in fact, this mentality will last a very long time in Moscow and will be the main reason that Moscow, or one of the main reasons Moscow ends up on top. Prior to the Mongol invasion, Moscow is a very tiny village on the Moskva River. The Moskva is itself a very small tributary of the Volga. So, so Moscow does not matter, but her line of princes will succeed in gaining the trust of the Golden Horde. The Muscovite princes will lead both Russian and Mongol armies in Moscow and elsewhere to put down anti-tax nationalist revolts against Mongol overlordship. Partially this is done out of self-interest, but partially it's done because rebellion against the Mongols at this era is absurd. No one has the strength to fight the Mongols at this particular period of time, as Moscow is rising in the 1300s. No one has the strength to deal with them. It will just mean a major massacre, which is how the Mongols deal with people who they don't like. And therefore, putting down a revolt using native Russian troops with some Mongol auxiliaries will lead to fewer deaths in the short run and in the long run than supporting a doomed rebellion, a rebellion doomed from the very beginning, and a rebellion that will only lead to more death and higher taxes in the future. The Russians, in addition to having to pay the tax, very high capitation taxes, as well as losing their most talented people in the 200 years of Mongol domination, they're kind of, kidnapped and sent all over the empire for various purposes. This is normal routine for the Mongols all over the empire, not just in Russia. You have the building up of a regular kind of a normal a tax gathering apparatus. Moscow is at the center of this. Taxes are continually increased, and so not only do you have taxes and the loss of talented men, you also have the necessity of all Russian princes, once they receive the Yarlik, they take the oath that they also have to contribute men, money, horses, armor, etc. to any further Mongol attacks in the future. All of this are the price that the princes have to pay to keep their heads and keep their thrones under the Mongol dominance. The Mongols, there's actually a lot of views on this. There are some people, particularly those outside of the Russian national movement today, like the Ukrainians, who hold that the Russians are, in fact, of Finnish background and Mongol background. There are those, your more Russian nationalist types, who hold that intermarriage was not very common, and therefore the old Slavic stock really wasn't changed all that much. I have a tendency, personally, to lean to the latter option. There was some intermarriage. Russians did view Mongol women as very attractive. They liked to blacken their teeth with soot because they thought that was more attractive that way. I don't really see what the attraction there was, but that's something that the kind of a fashion elite Mongol women. But the only actual intermarriage that I've ever come across in all the works that I've covered in Russian history, in Russian and in English, is that there is some elite intermarriage at the elite level. This was done in order to further solidify their role as a dominant political class in Russia working for the Mongols. In fact, the Muscovites regularly married into, at least at the elite level, into the Mongol major elite families in Sadai in order to solidify their control over all Russia. There wasn't, at the lower levels, mid-levels of the peasantry, there was no mixing of Russian and Mongol. The life of the average peasant did not change at any level. The life of the nobility changed only in that they were placed militarily at the service of the Mongol Empire. And yet they became very, very jealous of the growing power of the princes. The growing power of the princes was backed by Mongol weaponry. But to conclude this, I'm starting to run out of time here, and I'm sorry about that. You have four things. You have four major issues, four major things that came out of the Mongol experience. Number one, the Mongol Empire separated the Russians from the rest of Western Europe. Number two, the Mongol influence increased the desire of Russians for unity, gave the princes a tremendous amount of power in terms of tax gathering they never had before. Number three, that Moscow wins, Novgorod loses. And lastly, the church not only is respected by the Mongols, but the Mongols fear the Russian clergy. And this is very curious. The Mongols fear the Russian clergy. They believe that they're miracle workers. They believe that they're, you know, these extraordinary people. And the Mongols, once the initial invasion is over with, they won't mess with the average Russian clergyman at any level. And that's very, very interesting. So you have the victory of Moscow, separation from the West, dominance of the church, and the increasing power of the prince over and above the Russian aristocracy. Anyway, that's it for now. I've run out of time. I want to thank everyone. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned into Radio Aryan.